Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, in for Marty Moscowane. 248,000, that's the number of American college graduates working minimum wage jobs last year, according to the Wall Street Journal. Another survey reports that nearly half of 2010's college grads are working in jobs that don't require a bachelor's degree, and most of those jobs don't even require a high school diploma. Many of today's 20-somethings were coming of age just as the housing and job markets tanked. They've entered the real world armed with expensive college degrees and often major student loan debt. Even as the economy recovers, many find themselves jobless or underemployed at best. So this hour, we're talking about the plight of the millennial generation, what they're up against, and how they're coping with the financial realities they're facing. Joining us are Annie Lowry, a reporter for the New York Times Washington Bureau. Her article, Do Millennials Stand a Chance in the Real World, was published in last Sunday's New York Times Magazine. Annie, welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
And Tamara Drought is Vice President of Policy and Research at Demos, a public policy organization devoted to equality in our democracy as well as our economy. Demos has just released a sobering report about young adults and their prospects in the job market. Welcome, Tamara, to Radio Times.
Good to be with you, Tracy.
Well, Tamara, we tend to blame the recession for what young adults are experiencing right now, but your report, and Annie's article for that matter, suggests that the stage was set a long time ago for this.
It certainly was. And, you know, the reality is, heading into the recession, there were a lot of really troubling trends happening for young people. The two biggest were the growth in the cost of college, and with that, the new sort of normal of having to take out five-figure student loan debt in order to get that college degree. And then the second big trend that was already underway is if you looked at earnings for young people, particularly for the majority of young people who don't have those four-year degrees, and you compare what they were earning in the labor market to what their moms and dads were earning in the labor market a generation ago when they were in their 20s and early 30s, there had been a significant decline for all but the best educated workers. So when the recession hit, we already were in a pretty precarious place in terms of the ability for young people to get good paying jobs and to get a college degree without weighing themselves down with a lot of student loan debt. And the recession just intensified all of these trends.
And when you talk about the cost of college going up so significantly in recent years, a lot of that is the fact that funding has been cut, correct?
It is. Demos has done a lot of research looking at what is causing the very rapid rise we see in tuition. And again, you know, we saw a period of disinvestment that slowly sort of unfurled over a generation and then really intensified and in many states dropped off a cliff. And the result is that today the investment in higher education for, you know, our state universities and colleges, which is where the majority of people go to get a college degree, is 26% less than it was a generation ago.
Wow. Annie, the millennial generation has been accused of being pretty materialistic, at least by the baby boomer generation. But your piece in the New York Times Sunday Magazine suggests that that may not necessarily be the case, that millennials may be adopting more of a Depression-era perspective. Explain that.
So, yeah, on self-reported measures of how important it is to make a lot of money, millennials have tended much more so than Generation X or previous generations to kind of come off as materialistic. They think it's more important to be making a lot of money. And also, you know, the use of I statements and other measures of narcissism have gone up. And so I think that that might be kind of a broader cultural trend. But I think that the millennials have also evinced this certain kind of economic anxiety, in part because of recession, in part because their earning prospects are low. They're not making a lot of money. They know it. And it's really hard to get a job. A lot of them are underemployed. And also, even before the recession, wage growth was sluggish. A lot of these people, I think, saw their parents struggling. And the last time that we had kind of median wage growth adjusted for inflation was 1999. It was a really long time ago. And so I think that some of that economic anxiety is filtering through to the millennials also.
So I think that, you know, you could say that they're narcissistic, you can say that they're materialistic, but I think the flip side of that is that they're very, very worried, and with very good reason. They have a lot to be worried about.
Yeah, they are the Instagram generation. They photograph themselves quite a bit. But how is it manifesting then, Annie, in terms of, how is that economic anxiety manifesting itself?
Well, kind of the most basic measure is if you ask millennials how worried they are, you know, they kind of report that they're worried. It's funny because there's a little bit of dissonance. Their self-reported optimism is really high. They're pretty optimistic people, but they also just have kind of a ton of money concern. And I think that's because of the student loan debt. It's because of the low earnings. It's because of what they've seen happen to their parents. And so that's kind of one way of measuring it. They also actually tend to be kind of economically conservative. You know, they're not really looking to or able to take out a lot of debt. They're not really running up credit cards. So it's not as if this is a generation that's like their problem is that they're hitting the mall and kind of spending money that they don't have. It's not true. And so, you know, one part of that is definitely that it's hard for them to access credit. You know, it's pretty tough to get a credit card. It's tough to get a mortgage. But I also think that there is some self-reported behavior where these people are like, you know what, I don't really need a car. I'm going to use a car sharing service, or I'm going to live closer to work and bike. And those behaviors are changing. And I think it's going to be really interesting as millennials kind of grow up, watching how they carry those behaviors into adulthood. And just one other thing I'll mention is that other generations where you've had people who were young during a recession and the recession was really formative in their minds economically have tended to be a little bit more conservative, to even do some things like save more in bonds than in stocks. And so economists might expect millennials to kind of repeat those behaviors.
Well, and that brings up some interesting points. Certainly, the fact that they are becoming more creative in the way that they're doing things. You mentioned, you know, biking to work and car shares and those kinds of things. And Tamara, I'm just thinking about the fact that it's so much more difficult now for a young adult to buy that first home, to buy a decent car for themselves, things that maybe the baby boomers aspired to do and were almost taken for granted are now out of reach for a number of these younger adults.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. And there's been some interesting data out about the big decline in the share of home buying that is done by young people. You know, one of the reasons why our housing market hasn't quite rebounded as fully as it could is because, you know, as Annie mentioned, getting a mortgage is a lot harder these days. Saving up for a down payment because of those student loans and because of the drop in earnings has become much more challenging. And so what we're seeing is a real decline in home ownership among young people and a real decline in the percentage of home purchases that are going to those first-time buyers, which we need for our housing market to really thrive. So it has certainly gotten harder to purchase your first car, to purchase your first home. And, you know, I think that the going's going to be tough for a while. And for folks that live in cities where they can bike and do car sharing, it's great that they have those options. It's much more difficult for young people that live, you know, in urban areas that may not have as much public transportation, who live in the suburbs where, you know, owning a car is essential to getting to your job. So it's great that we see millennials in really tightly knit urban centers like D.C. and New York and Chicago and San Francisco being able to take advantage of alternative ways to get around. Unfortunately, that's really not a viable option for a lot of young people across the country.
Well, and neither is saving, I would think, because you've got, you know, so many of these college graduates are coming out, and I saw something where the, you know, the average student loan debt is something like anywhere from $22,000 to $26,000, but we know that there are those who have six-figure debt as well.
Yeah.
And so how does a young person then, given that burden, even save toward a car, save toward a home? Tamara?
Well, it's very difficult because let's think about the math behind here. You know, one of the things that has happened is in order to sort of get a middle-class job, it's become all but required to get that college degree. But we know at the same time that those middle-class earnings have been stuck in place since 1999. So what that means is we have a whole new crop of college grads that are having a hard time getting those middle class jobs. But even if they do, they now have to put and divert a lot more money toward debt payment that many generations never had to deal with. And you know that, you know, the average is around $26,000. That's about a $250 per month payment over 10 years, if you're lucky enough to be able to pay it down in 10 years. So that's money that can't go to saving for a down payment, can't go to purchasing a car, can't go into the retirement account that we all know we need to start saving in as soon as we get our first real job. So it's a pretty productive loss in terms of coming out of college with student loan debt payments that you're still going to be paying off when it's time to get married and have your own children.
Well, yeah, and Annie, as you pointed out, you know, these young people are at an age where when their parents were that age, they were saving and these things were just assumed. And so they were beginning to build some sort of wealth, some kind of net worth. And that's really being postponed, to say the least, for a lot of young adults. And that sort of leads us to the boomerang kids and that phenomenon of college kids, you know, graduating and then discovering that it makes a lot more sense to come back home and live with mom and dad. What can you tell us, Annie, about that trend?
So it's been a huge trend that actually also predated the recession of 20-somethings kind of moving back home. And I think that there's a lot of components, but at its heart, I think that one major one is that these folks, these 20-somethings, very often have student loan debt to pay off. So they have higher expenses, so they reduce my expenses elsewhere, and they go live at home. And so, you know, the question is kind of moving forward. I think that you made a really good point, which is that kind of the problem, even if millennials' earnings pick back up, even if we get some really strong economic growth that's shared really broadly, not just in certain regions but all across the country, strong wage growth, you know, a kind of economy that we haven't seen in a while now, if you delay saving because money compounds over time, it can still have an impact a really long time down the road. So if you delay a house purchase by 10 years and that house was going to appreciate in price, that can change your retirement savings by tens of thousands of dollars. And so I think that millennials are just put in kind of a tough spot, right? You know, they have this student loan debt. In a lot of cases, it makes sense to take that debt on if it's going to raise your earnings, but that's really hard. There's a lot of millennials who can't find jobs that they paid their degree in basically in order to get. There's also the problem that a lot of folks go to 2 or 4 year institutions and don't graduate. And there's some evidence that unless you graduate, you don't really get that earnings benefit because you don't get to say that you had a degree. And so there's just a lot of pressure on these young folks, and they're earning less, and they're saving less, and they're spending less. And all those things are interrelated.
No doubt. I want to stop here because we're about to take a break, but I would like to follow up on that about the value of a college education. It certainly is expensive, and then we have many young people who are coming out of school and being unemployed or underemployed at best, and we want to talk about that when we come back. We want to hear from you as well. Maybe you are a millennial or you are the parent of one. The number's 888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Support for WHYY is provided by Interact Theater Company and its revival of Permanent Collection. Inspired by the Barnes Museum, this gripping drama follows the newly hired executive director whose ideas for changing the Permanent Collection ignite a racially charged controversy. Permanent Collection runs April 5th through May 5th. For tickets, 215-568-8079 or online at interacttheater.org.
You probably know the name Angela Davis. You probably recognize her signature 1960s look, her huge afro. But do you really know her story?
Philosophy professor Angela Davis admitted that she is a member of the Communist Party.
Everybody had a file on her.
A new film aims to tell that story. We'll speak with producer Jada Pinkett Smith. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. Garrick Olson joins new music director Yannick Nezet-Séguin, who leads the Philadelphia Orchestra in Brahms' first piano concerto. Tickets available at philorc.org or at 215-893-1999. This Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at the Kimmel Center, Garrick Olson plays Brahms' First Concerto, and Yannick conducts the Philadelphia Orchestra.
You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane. We're talking about the plight of the millennial generation, what they are up against financially, with lots of student loan debt in many cases, a lousy housing market, job market, many of the difficulties that they are facing, and how they are coping with the financial realities of the current day. Our guests are Tamara Drought, who is Vice President of Policy and Research at Demos. It's a public policy organization devoted to equality in our democracy as well as our economy. And we're talking with Annie Lowry as well, who is a reporter for the New York Times Washington Bureau and who recently wrote a piece in the Sunday New York Times Magazine called "Do Millennials Stand a Chance in the Real World?" That is a question a lot of people are asking. And Tamara, I want to put this question to you because it begs the question, when college tuition has become so high, student loan debt has become so high, they're coming out of school, many times cannot find a job that's either in their field or that pays well enough to justify the expense that they took on with college. It begs the question, is a college degree still worth it?
You know, it's interesting that this has become the question we're all asking ourselves. You know, I guess I would put it this way, that if you go to college, you're stuck in a lot of ways, because of the student loan debt, but if you don't go to college, you're much more stuck than if you had gone. So I think the question that the growth of student loan debt presents us with is this the best way to ensure young people can get the education and training they need to get ahead in life and to be competitive in our economy? And the answer to that question, I think, is solidly no, for a couple reasons. One, we're seeing all kinds of really bad effects from the student loan debt on post-college life. We're going to see a decline in retirement savings, home ownership, delayed car buying. All of these things are both bad for individuals and our economy. But I think one of the bigger questions that gets lost in the "is college worth it" is that the debt for diploma system that we now sort of live under and that this generation has grown up with is leaving a lot of really bright, young, talented people from lower income backgrounds shut out of the system. There's been lots of survey research that shows that the number one reason why young people who are qualified to go to college either enroll and drop out or don't enroll at all is because of the financial barriers they face to getting that degree. So I would say at this point, you know, it is really scary out there. The fact that we have so many college graduates doing jobs that don't require their degree hopefully is cyclical, that this is going to, you know, as the economy rebounds, as we, and none of this is for certain, but I think having a college degree, even with the $26,000 in debt, gives you a much better chance at getting a decent job with health care benefits, with middle-class earnings, than not having that degree. And shame on us for attaching the level of debt to that that we've never asked a generation before to shoulder.
Well, let's invite a recent graduate to join us in our conversation. Jay, calling from Philadelphia. Welcome, Jay, to Radio Times.
Hi, thank you for having me. I just, you know, first I want to thank you for confirming some of these terrifying thoughts of self-doom over the next several years. But I also would like to hear, you know, I studied philosophy, so I have a BA in philosophy, and you know, I think you're talking about slightly more pragmatic degrees, things that, you know, can hopefully get you some money on your way out of college. It's interesting to think about the decline in the liberal arts education. So if you could talk about that a little bit, that'd be great.
All right. Thank you, Jay.
So I'll take a first stab at that. You know, one of the things that I think is troubling as the higher ed system has become sort of what I call a debt for diploma system is we start asking all these questions about return on investment and labor market value. And, you know, the idea that higher education is purely sort of a commodity, a means to an end in terms of good earnings in the labor market, sort of undervalues the overall mission of college and higher education, which is also fundamentally important to our democracy. And, you know, from the founding of the United States, we have consistently prioritized higher education and made deliberate attempts to open up access and make it more affordable. And what we're experiencing today is really a pretty radical departure from that idea of higher education as being a public good, as being important for our culture, for the arts, for our teachers, and then for more practical things like accountants and lawyers and doctors. But when we really start to commodify and only value learning for what it can achieve in terms of earnings in the labor market, we really start getting away from the overall importance of education to our society and to us as human beings.
So we've been downgrading, if you will, the value of a college education.
We've downgraded it, and we've also made it very individualized. We've lost sight of the fact that higher education and education in general, but particularly higher education, we've lost sight that this is a public good, that over history we have said needs to be a shared responsibility to support, because we all benefit when people can go to college and do the things that we need them to do, but also in terms of learn to think critically, to question the world that's around them, to be able to decipher the news and the debates that happen in this country and around the world. There's an unacknowledged benefit about the role higher education plays in ensuring people have the information and knowledge they need to navigate our democracy.
We'll go back to the phones right here in Philadelphia and welcome Laurie to Radio Times. Hi, Laurie.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I am blessed to have a job that I love, and I'm a little bit older than the generation you're talking about, not much, but my brother is definitely smack in the middle of it, and I also happen to employ him. But he's one of probably 10 to 15 who are approaching this decision-making process, and I've actually been amazed and impressed by their ingenuity in dealing with this kind of challenge. Taking on DIY projects, for instance, buying a house that is essentially a shell or a warehouse, and then learning the skills to rehab it into what they want. And that's something that I personally have seen a lot of in Philadelphia, just with my generation and the one directly below it. We may all have degrees that are of varying usefulness in the job market, but we're figuring out how to put the skills that we learned in college into use in ways that were not traditional or perhaps our parents never would have thought of.
Well, thank you, Laurie, for that. And Annie Lowry, I'd like you to speak to that, because it goes back to that creativity that we talked about a little while ago.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do think that there's this resurgence in interest in entrepreneurialism and kind of doing it yourself if nobody's going to do it for you. I think that there's kind of a push factor and a pull factor there. So maybe millennials are just more entrepreneurial, and they look at the job market and they kind of say, well, okay, I want to set out on my own. I have this big idea. There's some evidence that especially kind of college-educated millennials tend to leave jobs. They don't like doing grunt work. They actually leave jobs with a little bit of a higher rate than you would expect. But I also think that there remains, in no small part because of the recession, but also the economy that preceded it, a kind of a dearth of entry points for these people in good middle class jobs throughout the whole country. And so, you know, I think it's if there were a lot of jobs available, I also think that you might see fewer folks having to resort to do that. And, you know, when you think about building a business, one thing that I kind of worry about, too, is that very often it's expensive. You need financing. You need resources. And this isn't a generation that's going to have a lot of access to that either, right? It's really hard to get a business loan right now, along with a mortgage, along with a credit card and everything else. And so I think that that's going to be another factor that is going to perhaps prevent a lot of folks from starting businesses that would like to.
I wanted to just clarify what age group we are, in fact, talking about here. We talk about millennials. We talk about Generation Y. What age group, Tamara, are we talking about specifically?
You know, most people define the millennial generation as people born after 1981. So that means that the lion's share of millennials are sort of in the peak of their 20s and slowly making their way into their early 30s. And when you think about that age of life, the reason why it's so important to know what's happening during the 20s and early 30s is because that's when all the major life decisions get made. You know, what you're going to study, what you're going to do to make a living, when and where you're going to raise kids. You know, the average age of first birth in this country is age 25. So this is the parenting generation of young kids. There's a lot of important life cycle events that happen during your 20s and early 30s, and not having the opportunities available to get this stage right and get on track is going to ripple throughout the rest of their lives.
Yeah. We'll go back to the phones to Newark, Delaware, and welcome Robert to our conversation. Hi, Robert.
Hi. I had a question about, I'm a professor at the Arts Institute, and my question is, you know, does the government ever consider tying financial aid to degrees where people are actually needed? You know, because I watch my students take on huge amounts of debt, higher than that average that was, you know, mentioned earlier, and that their job prospects are very poor at that.
Well, Tamar, what do you say?
I appreciate where that sentiment is coming from in terms of being really worried about the amount of debt that folks are taking on for degrees at your institution. It does scare me a great deal to think about only providing financial aid to students that are willing to go into, let's say, the STEM fields where we know there's going to be a lot of need for people to have those skills, or into nursing or something like that. I think it gets back to this idea that individuals aren't really individuals anymore, that we can just say, okay, I'm going to be a nurse even if I have none of the sort of requisite skills or passions in providing care or learning about biology, because that's where we need workers. And I think that it really distorts the benefits and importance of higher education, particularly liberal arts education, when we think of only providing financial aid to people who are going to study fields where we know there's going to be good job growth.
Yeah, and you know, this is Annie. There have been some efforts by legislators to do just that, and I think that part of the pushback is that that's really the government, if it ended up being the government who said, okay, we're going to provide, you know, either larger loans or cheaper loans to people who go into fields like STEM, that it's the government interfering in the market, right, and that you could end up, what would happen if they kind of guessed wrong, and in fact, this part of engineering wasn't a growth wasn't, you know, growing really fast afterwards. So I think that there's a lot of concern that even though that sounds like a really good idea, that if people want to do it, it maybe should be left to, like, private foundations as opposed to the government to make it cheaper for folks to go into those fields. Because hypothetically, you know, students should know going into college, this is pretty well-paying, also this is something that aligns with my interests. So...
good points, for sure. Let's go to North Wales and welcome Connie to Radio Times. Hi, Connie.
Hi. I would like to weigh in on what we're calling the conceit of parents in jacking up student loan debt. We're raising two teenagers in quite an affluent community, and we live on a modest income, and our girls are in the honors program at the community college, and so their tuition is paid. But they're seeing their classmates kind of being forced by their parents to go to very expensive schools and then having to take out a lot of loans. What's your take on that?
Annie Lowry, I'll start with you on that.
Yeah, so, you know, I think that this is a problem, and it's interesting where there's actually a lot of concern for folks who are maybe a little bit older, maybe in their 50s, who are helping shoulder some of the burden of the student loan debt for their kids, and also have parents and are kind of sandwiched by these two generations, you know, whose parents are perhaps in declining health or getting older, that's putting a real squeeze on them. And so I think that it's hard to overstate state how profound an effect all of this student loan debt is having economically on all sorts of different families, from folks who are going to very expensive four-year schools to folks who are just getting associate degrees or going to other types of programs, even job training programs. I think that it has a really kaleidoscopic impact, and I think it's a good point to make that parents are shouldering a fair amount of this burden as well.
Well, and Annie, when you think about parents who now might be at the age where at least they're beginning to think about retirement, hopefully they've been saving for it over the years, but they normally would be moving in that direction, but now, to your point, they're helping out with this student loan debt and so forth. It sort of raises the question, what will things look like for millennials when they get to that point? If parents right now are struggling with these issues and trying to manage their own retirement as well as their student, students' loan debt and the cost of college tuition, what might retirement look like for this generation?
So this is really scary, and it's worth pointing out that folks that are in their 40s and 50s now are also not set for retiring. They're in a really bad spot. A lot of them lost a lot of value in their homes that they had expected to be there. And there's some concern for yet younger folks that there's going to be a lot of pressure on the Social Security system, and even if it's still going to be existent and is still going to be paying out, that legislators are looking to cut it. And at the same time, it's getting harder and harder for these folks to save money for themselves. And so some of the options that I've heard talked about in Washington are things that basically opt you into savings accounts rather than having you opt out. That might be one option. Changing some of the structure of some of the tax credits and how they're allocated, or even deductions and how they're allocated, could help as well. But it's the sort of thing that you have to start thinking about early because, again, if you get on a bad savings trajectory, it can have a very long-range impact. And I think that there's a lot of concern about the retirement security of basically everybody at this point.
Well, and Tamara Drought, that's one of the ideas that was put forth in the Demos report as well.
Yes, I mean this is a widespread problem that really demands a pretty robust public solution. The reality is none of us are really well prepared for retirement, and the options that are available are limited, are pretty risky. The 401k, we saw with the financial collapse, folks who were on the cusp of their retirement losing significant amount of their retirement and their 401k system after building that up for decades. So I think we have to do some really hard thinking about what is the best way to supplement the Social Security system that is safer, that is guaranteed, so that when the millennials are in their 50s to early 60s, they can count on a defined benefit that isn't going to move up and down with the stock market.
Well, we're about to take a short break, but when we come back, we want to talk a little bit more about some of the solutions that are being proposed, the solutions as well as silver linings. Where is the good news in all of this? We'll be talking about that with our guests and with you if you'd like to join our discussion. 888-477-9499. Radio Times, we'll be right back.
For 19 years, the Philadelphia Invitational Furniture Show has brought together patrons and artisans. Once again, the show is downtown at the 23rd Street Armory on 23rd Street, just south of Market, and runs from Friday evening, April 5th, to Sunday the 7th. Featuring modern and traditional tables, chairs, beds, textiles, lighting, and tabletop items. PIFS supports WHYY. More info at philaifs.com. The Philadelphia Invitational Furniture Show. Art you can live with.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Sally Krawcheck was hired and fired twice on Wall Street. She has a no-holds-barred look at what she says still needs to be fixed in the financial world. Also, Rob Morseberger, making music as he faces his mortality. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Hello, I'm Russell Kaufman, president of the Wistar Institute, a proud supporter of WHYY. For over 100 years, Wistar scientists have helped keep your families, friends, and employees healthy because of our research that guides the creation of early-stage drugs. We then work with the pharmaceutical industry for their final production. Our name may not be on these cancer drugs, but our fingerprints are all over them. To learn more about how Wistar keeps you healthy and our region economically strong, online at wistar.org.
You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moskowain, and we're talking about millennials and what they're up against. It's very difficult to not have a conversation at some point or see a headline about what young adults right now are dealing with in terms of student loan debt, in terms of a very difficult job market, and so on. And we're talking about how they're coping with all of that. Our guests are Annie Lowry, who is a reporter for the New York Times Washington Bureau, and Tamara Drought, who is Vice President of Policy and Research at Demos, which is a public policy organization. And as we begin to shift our discussion to the solutions and to where is the good news, if any, in all of this, I want to invite our listeners to join us. The number is 888-477-9499 or WHYY. Maybe you are a millennial. Maybe you're the parent of one. Maybe you are an educator. We'd love to hear your take on this as well. But I'm wondering, and I'll start with you, Tamara. Is this sustainable? When we think about the cost of college tuition, the amount of debt that many young people are coming out of college with, the number of graduates who are continually entering into a slow job market, if nothing changes, where are we going here, and how sustainable is this?
Great question. The question of whether it's sustainable, probably. One thing we haven't talked about is the massive and historic levels of inequality that this generation is growing up in, which is not at all separate from the reality that a lot of them face, because it is the result of major disinvestment in things that we all benefit from, higher education being one of them. You know, I think the future is bleak if we don't really harness the political and public will to turn this picture around for young people. I think we're looking at, one of the things about this generation, it's the most diverse generation in our nation's history. And within that diversity, we see severe disparities in terms of who has a job and the types of jobs they're getting. So one of the things we think a lot about is the future middle class in this country and what needs to happen to make sure that in 20 years we have a middle class that reflects the diversity of the nation and that is strong and growing. And that's going to take a lot of new public policy and a lot of new thinking about what we need to do to ensure that people really do have an equal chance in this economy, because when you look at the major differences in levels of unemployment by race or by level of education, we're seeing a serious pulling apart among this generation.
Well, and the Demos report, Tamara, says specifically that for African American and Hispanic students, that as bad as the numbers are, they are much worse for those groups.
They are much worse. You know, among young African Americans, those who are 18 to 24, the unemployment rate, we have one out of four young African Americans who cannot find a job in this economy, and it's around 16% for Latinos. So, you know, if you look at either by education or by race and ethnicity, we have basically across the board a doubling of their rates of unemployment. And it's going to take a lot to ensure that these young people don't get totally left behind in this economy.
Annie Lowry, what are your thoughts? Is this sustainable?
You know, so I think that if you want to get really, really depressed,
if we're not depressed enough,
it's this really big question. So the upside is that broad-based economic growth that is lifting the wages of a large swath of American workers is going to be the medicine that cures a whole lot of ills, right? These problems just become a lot easier to solve if you have prosperity and it's widely shared. But I think that the thing that you can get really depressed thinking about is that we've seen pretty good job growth in low-wage jobs
even if there's a lot more competition for them and there's not enough of them. We've seen pretty good job growth in high-wage jobs, even if there aren't enough of them either. But there's been this hollowing out of the middle class. It's been, you know, tidal forces for the past 30 years of technological change and a whole bunch of other factors. And I think that it's a really bad question. I think that there's absolutely a racial dimension to this. Workers who are members of racial minorities have tended to earn less. They've tended to accrue less wealth, even when they have the same credentials as people who might be white. You know, they're doing worse off. And I think it's a really big problem. I actually think it's an element of the problems with economic opportunity that we've seen and mobility that we've seen that kind of remains understated and underexplained. And so I think that one good thing is that there's a lot of attention to this issue. There's a lot of ideas around it, but it is very scary, and it's hard because these are really big questions, and I don't think we really know the answers to any of them.
Well, we've got lots of people who would like to speak with both of you, so let me go to the phones right here in Philadelphia. We'll welcome Gerald to Radio Times. Hi, Gerald.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Well, I'm a millennial myself. I was born in 1984, and one of the reasons I think the cost of college has risen substantially faster than health care or inflation is due to all the government involvement of guaranteed subsidies. Colleges have no reason really to contain costs when they're guaranteed a new round of students every year with almost unlimited federally backed subsidies of their student loans.
All right. Well, let me send that one to Tamara.
Sure. You know, I could see why it makes sense to look at sort of has the availability of student loans created sort of no pressure on colleges to be accountable. And I think without question, if all student loans and the ability to get them went away, colleges would face new pressures to lower their costs. So I think it's one factor. I do also think, though, if you look at one of the main drivers of increases in tuition is the decline in public investment, because the majority of state universities and colleges get their revenue, their operating money, from state money. And that is where we've seen a big decline. And when that declines, after they cut costs, tuition is really the only lever they have left to make up for that gap in funding. The other thing I will say is that colleges have a luxury that there is more demand than there is supply. And parents and young people have certainly gotten the message that they need to get the best college and the most college that they can afford. And clearly, now that we have $1 trillion in student loan debt, they are willing to go into debt to make that happen. So there's a lot of demand pressures on these systems, and I think you make a good point. It is possible to keep raising tuition, knowing that there are plenty of people out there willing to put themselves in dire financial straits in order to get a degree and hopefully have some chance of getting into the middle class.
We haven't mentioned community colleges here, and Annie, I'm wondering what your thoughts are about the role of community colleges. Many millennials, I think, are deciding to go that route.
Yeah, and I think that there's been, especially since the recession hit, a lot of attention to these being really, really great and high-value alternatives for a lot of students. I think that they could use a lot more public investment, and you could use a lot more, like many more of them, many more slots. I think that this has been a real concern. But, you know, you have seen more people going to them, and I think that to a certain extent, though, the concern is the same, right, is if people are taking too much debt on, especially if they're dropping out and not finishing, that can be very, very troubling, and that those people might not be getting the wage benefit of going to school, but might be taking on debt pretty significantly early in their lives in order to go.
Yeah. Let's see if we can squeeze in a call here. We'll go to Warminster to Jessica. Welcome, Jessica, to Radio Times.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I had wanted to speak to first-time homebuyers of the current generation. Myself, I graduated college in 2007, and in 2011, I just bought my first home up in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, through the Lehigh Valley Community Land Trust. And what that organization does is they buy up foreclosed properties in the area, and they gut them and completely redo them, and they have a great model to assign costs to the houses so that people like myself can afford homes to buy for the first time, and then if I choose to resell, there's a whole model as to what the cost would be so we can pass that savings along. And I just wanted to say that I don't know how well-publicized organizations like the Land Trust are, but I know they exist, and it was a great option for me to buy over renting because my mortgage is lower than any comparable houses would have been to rent, and it's been great owning my own home. So I think something like a land trust is a great place to look for first-time home buyers.
Well, thank you, Jessica. And Annie, that speaks to, you know, creativity and knowing where to look, that there is some help available if you know where to find it.
Absolutely. And I think the flip side is that a lot of folks who are maybe in their early 30s and another time would have built up a bit of a nest egg and had been thinking about buying a house would have been really delighted by the decline in home prices that we've seen in some neighborhoods and by the really low interest rates. And that's kind of one of the pernicious things is that right now is very often a good time to buy a house. It's probably a pretty good investment because of those low interest rates, mm-hmm. and a lot of younger folks are locked out because they haven't been able to save up enough and because credit standards remain really, really tight. And so, you know, I think that there's a lot of great pilot programs to address this issue, but macroeconomically, it's actually also interesting with refinancing, where it hasn't really tended to help the lower-income families that could most use that help by refinancing and taking advantage of the really, really historically low interest rates that we still have right now.
Let's go to Allentown, and we'll welcome Tyson to Radio Times. Hi, Tyson.
Yeah, hi. I was calling because I was thinking about the baby boomer generation who, obviously, there's a huge number of baby boomers still in the job market, but who aren't retiring due to either they don't have a pension of some sort or aren't, you know, they still are holding on to their job for some reason because of inability to retire. And I was wondering how much the baby boomer generation is affecting the job market for young adults.
Good question. Tamara, what do you say?
It is certainly affecting it. The reality is there hasn't been the turnover that we would have expected for exactly the reasons you cite, which is, you know, a lot of the baby boomers thought they'd be retiring about right now and then opened their 401k systems, their statements, and said, well, need a new plan. And so they are two things. They're staying in their jobs longer than you know, previous trends would have thought. And two, if they left their jobs, they're actually back out in the job market and also competing for some of those part-time, lower-wage jobs that young people, particularly without college degrees, typically need, you know, to get their first labor market experience. So it's a piece of the puzzle for sure.
Tamara, I know that you touched on this a little while ago, but I'd like to come back to some of the policy recommendations from the report. In a nutshell, what are some things that need to happen in order to begin to turn things around or to provide some relief for this generation?
Yeah, so many things. And the depressing part is, you know, the gap between what's needed and what's probably politically viable. But I want to piggyback on what the caller was talking about in terms of the land trust, because one of the things that we propose in our report today out on the youth jobs crisis is really aimed at putting young people back to work in service of the community. And so if you think about if we could develop programs like the one in the Lehigh Valley that she spoke about, where we have young people put to work to rehab homes, and at the same time they're earning money, they're generating community value in terms of preventing a neighborhood from spiraling downward because home values decline pretty rapidly when you have a block full of foreclosed properties. There are all sorts of infrastructure needs, community needs, that if we could find the political will and really admit to ourselves that this is an investment we're going to get back if we are reaching young people who have been locked out of this labor market and putting them to work in service of our nation, It's money that will be well spent. I have very little optimism that we will do that, because I think we continue to face these pressures of in terms of concern over the deficit and the austerity politics of today. But I think, you know, the hour of this conversation has been startling and concerning, and really sort of demonstrates the need for a large-scale revitalization of the social contract here.
And Annie Lowry, in our last 60 seconds, what do you say? What needs to change in order to provide some relief here?
So I think that both Democrats and Republicans in Washington are very, very concerned about this. They know about it. They fight about it. The problem is that their solutions are very often completely oppositional to one another. But I do think that there are some bipartisan ideas out there that you could see passed that might actually get some support and could be really powerful. So again, one of those is just opting people into retirement accounts. So when you get a job, you automatically are saving for retirement. You don't even have to do anything. And all the behavioral economics suggest that this is a pretty powerful thing, as opposed to having to go and call and sign up for a retirement account yourself. And so I do think that there are some solutions that could really, really help. And I think that in housing and in education, it'll be very interesting in the years to come to see whether Democrats and Republicans come together to kind of tackle those problems. And I'm not terribly optimistic that they will.
Well, I want to thank both of you. Annie Lowry, who is a writer for the New York Times Washington Bureau, thank you for being with us. And Tamara Drought is Vice President of Policy and Research at Demos. They have just released a very sobering report about millennials and what they're up against. Thanks to both of you for being with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, our producers have been Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Patty McMahon, and Emily Bryant. And our engineer is Kevin Griffin. And I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane. Tomorrow on Radio.